Hi, I'm Emily Morrow, and you're listening to Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review. On today's episode, we speak with organizers with People's Parity Project, a national nonprofit advocating for equal access to justice. We also speak with Nora Erekat, author of the new book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Let's get started.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Taking Liberties from Harvard Civil Rights Civil Liberties Law Review. My name is Avery.
And I'm Stephanie.
Today is Friday, October 4th, and we will be talking with Andre Manuel and Emma Janger from the People's Parity Project. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being here with us today. So can you tell us, what is the People's Parity Project?
Yeah, so the People's Parity Project is a newly formed national nonprofit organization with chapters at 8 law school campuses, founded at Harvard's campus last year. And I'll talk a little bit about the history. I mean, Emma can talk a little bit more about what we're doing today. So it was founded in spring of 2018 in this sort of unique moment where two big pieces of news sort of broke at the same time. And the first was that Alex Kaczynski, a judge on the Ninth Circuit, it had come out that he had engaged in a pattern of sexual harassment and assault against his law clerks for many, many years. And the second piece of news was that some law firm summer associates discovered that their contracts for their summer associate jobs contained forced arbitration clauses that would sort of preclude their ability to sue if something went wrong, such as being sexually harassed at work or facing any other kind of employment discrimination. And, you know, a bunch of organizers at Harvard Law, especially female law students, saw both of these pieces of news as connected and two ways that the legal profession was really inhospitable to women who were hoping to be lawyers and to rise the ranks in their careers. And sort of frustration at these two events sort of led organizers to come together to create this organization.
Yeah, so we're now a national nonprofit, as Andre mentioned, with chapters at 8 schools with a broader but still rooted in that same vision, mission to basically focus on the way that the legal profession and legal tools harm both those of us in the legal profession, such as future clerks and associates at law firm, but also to fight for justice for workers, consumers, and other marginalized groups and the ways that the law is specifically rigged against them. So we like to say that we're fighting to unrig the law. So far, we've really focused on two strategic priorities: dismantling the coercive legal tools that allow corporations to get away with violating workers' rights, ripping off consumers, and then shielding themselves from accountability for those violations, and then also to ensure that the judiciary as a whole is representative of and thus responsive to workers, women, people of color, LGBTQ people, basically anyone who isn't a wealthy white man or a corporation. So that's where we are now, and at this point, yeah, we're at 8 schools, we have a national leadership board, and we're really excited to take this fight well beyond the halls of Harvard Law School.
Why did you personally get involved with PPP?
So I got involved around this time last year, around Kavanaugh's nomination. I was distraught, frankly, by what I was witnessing from the judiciary, but also what I was witnessing here at Harvard in terms of a lack of leadership and a lack of moral courage to say, this man should not be nominated to the judiciary. Frankly, this man should not teach on our campus. At the time that he was nominated, he was scheduled to be teaching a winter term course, and that was sort of the first wave of organizing around his nomination here on campus and around the allegations from Christine Blasey Ford, which just, if there is someone who's been credibly accused of sexual assault, he cannot be on our campus unless there has been a process to ensure that students are safe here. That is a violation of having a safe educational space for all people, particularly women. And so that was really how I got involved. My first sort of, you know, we phone banked about his nomination, we walked out about his nomination, we wrote very, very angry emails about his nomination. But from that, we also turned to sort of, again, these broader issues of systemic injustice. So soon after he was confirmed, the first big PPP project I worked on was we wrote a formal comment letter to the Federal Judicial Conference, which at the time was making rule changes to its code of conduct for all the federal judges in wake of the Kaczynski scandal, which Andre mentioned. And so we wrote a formal comment letter, blue book for fun, and we're able to submit that to the federal judiciary with our recommendations for what would truly make clerks safe from harassment, you know, some of those recommendations were taken, some weren't, but that was how I personally got involved.
Yeah, so I had a little bit of a different path to joining PPP. I was also upset and deeply frustrated by the Kavanaugh nomination and that whole process, and became aware of some of the awesome organizing they were doing here on campus during that. But I really became involved sort of later on in that year around some of the forced arbitration work that PPP was doing. So I have a little bit of a consumer protection background before I came to law school. I worked at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau down in D.C., and a major priority of the regulations office while I was there was writing a rule that would have banned the use of forced arbitration clauses in consumer finance contracts, so your credit card contracts, student loans, mortgages, etc. Unfortunately, after the rule was issued, the Republican Congress and President Trump used the Congressional Review Act to repeal that. And so that was a deeply sort of frustrating, informative experience for me. And so when I came to law school and learned that PPP was organizing around forced arbitration, primarily at that time in the worker space, but also interested in thinking about the ways they play into consumer contracts as well, I was sort of really excited to sort of get involved in that.
Great. You know, I remember on campus last year, the PPP was everywhere, and it was really a refuge, I think, for students who were very distraught over the Kavanaugh nominations, as I was myself. Can you talk about, you talked about kind of what the PPP was doing at that time, which was just about exactly a year ago. How has the PPP's mission evolved since then and over the past year? How did it grow from being, you know, one student group here at Harvard to the national organization that it is today?
Yeah, I mean, I think the national organization has really been a somewhat natural outgrowth of this Harvard group that we started. You know, in addition to the organizing around Kavanaugh, around the same time, we were continuing our forced arbitration work and were able to force six of the nation's largest law firms to drop their forced arbitration clauses, not just for summer associates, which again is where it had started, but for all staff, including non-legal staff, who usually are paralegals, other support staff that really don't have the same leverage. And I think in sort of seeing that success, we realized how much privilege and power we had to change the conversation around these issues and to advocate not just for ourselves, but for workers and consumers more broadly. And then we honestly just got a lot of really great feedback from other law schools, from other law students, from other organizations in sort of related movements, that this was a new and necessary voice. And it was one that was worth taking off campus and really making its own project. And so a lot of my time this summer was spent dealing with sort of the formal process of that, but then also recruitment at these chapters. Our goal for September was to have five and chapters, and we have eight. And, you know, we're sort of trying to not grow too fast too quickly. Mm-hmm. But the interest that we have seen across schools, across law students nationwide is amazing. I mean, I think it really outstripped what we expected to happen as we started to recruit for chapters elsewhere. We're like, okay, will we get this? Will we get this? It's like, no, people have come to us. You know, we'll talk to people and they'll find all their friends who want to do it. And it's really just been incredibly inspiring. Our chapter at University of Michigan had their first big kickoff lunch talk last week called How to Impeach a Supreme Court Justice, hypothetically, which we loved. And they had, I think, over 100 people turn out, and they're also much smaller than us, so that's great. Amazing. Yeah. And they were saying that, you know, some of it was the amazing panel they put together, some of it was the topic, but some of it was they'd heard of PPP, and they wanted to find out more, and there was this sort of, like, name recognition already that they had going into that room, which was just, we were, like, chills to hear that already, so it was really exciting.
That is exciting. I would love to hear more about how you got involved with the Let's Reclaim the Court.
Yeah.
And I know it's the anniversary of Kavanaugh's appointment coming up this weekend, and I would love to hear how that relationship really got started.
Yeah, I mean, Reclaim the Court is being sort of co-led by Women's March, the Center for Popular Democracy, and Demand Justice. And the Center for Popular Democracy and Demand Justice in particular, we've had a pretty close working relationship with for a while. CPD has been helping us with some more behind-the-scenes stuff, but Demand Justice in particular saw our work around Kavanaugh, saw that we were getting law students to talk about the Supreme Court not just as a thing in our casebooks that, like, wrote the things we read for homework, but as this, like, living, breathing, frankly, political institution that had a real impact on our lives. And I think, so we've been partnering with them, and that's how we got pulled into the Reclaim a Court rally. So we're co-sponsoring it. We are getting in the car and driving down to D.C. tomorrow. And, yeah, that's how that relationship got started.
And just for those of listeners who don't know, what exactly is the Reclaim the Court rally?
So Reclaim the Court is a rally outside the Supreme Court on Sunday, basically on the anniversary of Kavanaugh's confirmation, the vote itself, saying that this is a sham seat. This, the investigation into him was a sham. His vote was pushed through Congress. He shouldn't have that seat, and the court should not be in the power of the right wing that it currently is in the power of. And we are making our voices heard, making our presence known that we are here to reclaim the court. I think a lot of people, PPP included, are specifically calling for Kavanaugh to be impeached due to the lack of process and, frankly, the lack of honesty that Kavanaugh showed at the hearings last year. You know, we all, you know, dates in his calendar notwithstanding, we know he lied in front of Congress, and we know that the FBI did not interview all the witnesses that came forward. And it's a sham investigation and deserves to be reopened, and there needs to be more process.
Yeah, and so there's a few intersecting issues, I think, that Reclaim the Court and PPP are hoping to draw attention to at the rally, sort of as Emma just touched up on. You know, one of the big ones is that a man who was credibly accused of sexual assault without a thorough investigation then lied to the Senate and was appointed to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court, which obviously has important ramifications, both for due process, but also for the legitimacy of the court as an institution. And the second issue, as Emma also touched on, was the process by which Republicans in the Senate blocked President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland for almost a year, and later added two new justices to the Supreme Court. So we want to draw attention to both their takeover of the Supreme Court, which is going to hear a number of sort of really important and influential cases in the upcoming term that will affect pretty much rights for any group you care about, but also the Republican takeover of the judiciary as a whole. Donald Trump has appointed judges at a lightning speed rate, faster than most presidents in American history, and the Supreme Court is literally just the tip of the iceberg here, and so I think we're hoping to sort of shine a light on all of that on Sunday.
So in a time in our nation's history when there is such a focus on justice for sexual violence, what do you think of the impact of having someone accused of sexual assault sitting as a Supreme Court justice?
I mean, I think it really shows that as much as we have shared our stories, we've taken to the streets, and we've started to maybe have some men removed from power in certain circumstances, overall, this is still a powerful image of how the powerful in this country don't take women, women's pain, or women's trauma seriously. I think it's frankly not just that Kavanaugh is sitting on the court today, though of course that is important. It's also that as we are around this anniversary of his nomination, we're hearing stories of how Christine Blasey Ford hasn't been able to move home. She hasn't been able to work. And the absolute consequences of her stepping forward have fallen on her. And we as a country have done nothing to protect her from that. That is not only a tragedy personally for her, which of course it is, but I think that sends and is intended to send an incredibly powerful message to women throughout this country that if you come forward, your life will be ruined. And for all the talk that, you know, is Me Too ruining men's lives, no, it's not. Every now and then they don't get a promotion, though Justice Kavanaugh obviously did since I called him Justice. But the true pain is on the women who come forward. And I think it's not just about the symbolism of that. I mean, we just heard today that the Supreme Court granted cert in June Medical Services versus Gee, which is the big Louisiana abortion rights case that threatens to overturn, if not Roe v. Wade, then at least Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt. And I think it's crucial to see those two events as incredibly linked. One, they both devalue women, their bodily autonomy, their power over their own lives. But also, this case is a huge reason that, you know, the sham investigation that Andre was talking about happened. The Republicans were out there for a couple of key reasons, I think abortion rights in particular being one of them. That is why they wanted a majority on the court, and that's one of the reasons, though not the only one, they were so intent on pushing Kavanaugh through, even after it became clear that he was not fit to serve on the court.
So I think, as Emma said, the sort of symbolism is pretty stark and horrible in this day and age. But there's also just the worrisome aspect that not one, but two justices credibly accused of sexual assault will be adjudicating a number of really important cases for rights of women and LGBTQ people this upcoming term. Emma talked about a really important one that threatens access to abortion throughout the country. Another one is the suite of cases that's going to be argued related to discrimination against LGBTQ people under Title VII. You know, Title VII is all about your ability to fight back against workplace harassment, including sexual harassment and assault in the workplace, and the fact that two justices who've been credibly accused of such conduct are going to be adjudicating a case determining whether or not these rights are going to be extended to millions of Americans should really trouble anyone who cares about fairness and rights.
So it sounds like you place Kavanaugh's appointment as sort of a central factor in the Me Too movement overall. Where do you consider PPP as fitting in with the broader Me Too movement?
I mean, first of all, obviously, we are very big supporters of the overall movement. But I think one of the things that I love about PPP and the way we organize across these issues is that in terms of Me Too specifically, we're able to link something like the rights takeover of our federal judiciary and the contract you may have signed last week for a job and explain how both of them are implicated in perpetuating this culture that has allowed for harassment and assault to be kept under wraps, to continue on, to persist, and to harm women and other marginalized communities. I think at the same time, one of the things that I also appreciate is that that's not all we look at. You know, the same thing that might harm a woman who is assaulted on the job is gonna harm someone who has a wage and hour violation, the same contract clause, the same judiciary. And being able to see how these issues are so linked and that this is not a singular issue with a singular solution, it is a broad issue that has to do with pretty much all issues of workplace safety, workplace fairness, rights for consumers and workers, and that we can't fight this as a singular fight. It has to be, you know, in conjunction with those broader movements.
So beyond the march on Sunday, I'm curious if Reclaim the Court or PPP or even either of you two personally have ideas or an agenda to truly reclaim the court. Are you in favor of court packing if the Democrats take control, for example? Are you in favor of term appointments for the Supreme Court? Any other measures that you think might make a more equitable judiciary moving forward?
So personally, I don't have a like preferred answer to the problem that is Kavanaugh being on the Supreme Court and the conservative takeover of the Supreme Court and all levels of federal courts. But I do think that we need to sort of elevate this as a topic of conversation. So beyond the march, you know, it's important to sort of, if you can attend the march, please attend. If you can't, you know, tweet about it on social media and sort of still amplify those voices. And beyond that, you know, call your reps to talk about issues of the takeover of the judiciary, talk about impeaching Kavanaugh, and broadly sort of push people running for office, I think especially Democratic presidential primary candidates. It's been really sad to watch three debates now and have yet to see a single question about the Supreme Court or any court. And, you know, I think I can speak for all of us when I say we'd really like to see people talking about this sort of really fundamental issue in the 2020 election.
Yeah, I think for us, you know, it's not about a specific plan for court reform, but it is about the idea that we on the left need to be energized as Supreme Court voters. That's something we've seen the right do with incredible success. That's why these men are on the court. That's why these cases that are coming before the court are so scary. And we need to be that energetic about being Supreme Court voters, about following lower court nominations. I know that Menasche and Scalia have made a little bit of news as appellate court nominees, but for the most part, they just get voted on. And I mean, Trump has just confirmed an outrageous number of people who are going to be on the bench for decades to come and shaping our laws for decades to come. I think in terms of a specific plan that the co-sponsors of Reclaim the Court as well as PPP have endorsed, one is the idea of putting no more corporate lawyers on the Supreme Court. Currently, according to the Cato Institute, prosecutors are 4-1 more represented than criminal defense lawyers on the bench. And 85% of federal judicial nominees were either corporate attorneys or prosecutors or both. And when you have a bench that's made up of people who've been representing companies for the most part, it's not surprising that the Roberts Court has sided with the Chamber of Commerce 70% of the time in cases. So whether there's court packing or term limits, I don't know what the right answer is, but I do know that we need a Supreme Court that includes people who are coming from tour public defenders, people who are impact litigation firms who are fighting for our civil rights, people who have a different experience and are going to see the law differently and protect those rights that we care so much about.
So I'm really interested in getting involved in PPP, but I'm not able to make it to the march this weekend. How can fellow HLS students and other listeners get involved?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So if you're here at Harvard Law, PPP meets every Wednesday at noon around lunchtime. So get in touch with us about sort of meeting time and place, and please come to our meetings. We're organizing and getting involved some really important issues this semester and have some cool plans in the work. So, touching on what Emma just said about diversifying the federal judiciary, sort of one of our ways of approaching that is thinking much earlier about federal clerks and diversifying the pool of people who can be federal clerks. And we've noticed there are a ton of barriers to access that prevent people who are not wealthy white men from becoming federal clerks. And so we're working on a project to think about some of the financial and other barriers to applying and receiving clerkships that prevent that pipeline from sort of fully representing the spectrum of law students. And so that's one issue we're working on here on campus. We're continuing to pressure law firms to drop their forced arbitration clauses for lawyers and other support staff. We have this really awesome partnership with Lambda here at Harvard Law, and Lambda and LGBTQ groups at other law school campuses across the country to sort of pool our bargaining power to pressure more law firms to drop their forced arbitration clauses. And then we'll also continue to push for legislative policy and other solutions, push at the sort of individual company level, at the local government level, at the state government level, and at the federal level to fight forced arbitration on all fronts, because we think that's still a critical issue.
Yeah, I echo, of course, everything that Andre said. And then for listeners who may not be on Harvard's campus, in terms of the march this weekend, you can absolutely amplify the message on social media. You can follow us at People's Parity on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll be posting all the time on Sunday. You can also join our mailing list to get more updates if we're on one of your law school campuses. That's peoplesparity.org. But then broader than that, you can call your representatives about impeaching Kavanaugh or investigating him more fully. But you can also call your senators about the FAIR Act. The FAIR Act is legislation that just passed the House for the first time in 10 years after it was first introduced, just passed the House, and would outlaw forced arbitration for consumer and employment contracts. And we would love for the Senate to actually look at the bill. So if you want to call your senators about considering and supporting and co-sponsoring the FAIR Act, that would also be another way to get involved in more of our substantive work.
Emma and Andre, thank you so much for being here today and taking the time to share your message. We know you both need to pack and get ready to head to D.C., so we'll let you go.
Of course, it was our pleasure. This was
wonderful. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm here today with Professor Noor Araketh, Palestinian-American legal scholar, professor, and author of the new book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. I met Noor about 2 years ago at a retreat for Black immigrant and Palestinian organizers. You likely don't know this, but before then and since, I've learned a lot from you on how to think about Palestinian liberation, how to think about solidarity, doing solidarity in my own work, and how to be a formidable and brilliant woman of color, abolitionist, justice work, lawyer. So it's a joy to be here with you.
Woo! I love all of it.
So Israel's in the news in the midst of the elections and, obscured in this fanfare around this seemingly democratic exercise is the fact that 5 or so million Palestinians of occupied Palestine are barred from voting in an election that determines their future. So if Palestinians aren't living in a democracy in what we call Israel, what are they living under? Occupation, apartheid?
No, it's a really good question, and I think, you know, I think it's right to start with the Israeli elections. So we see these Israeli elections, and it's the second one in this year, because Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government in April. So this is basically a second election and a go-around, and most of the media coverage around it is about whether or not Netanyahu is going to win and therefore evade some sort of prison sentence. And that's our sensibility around it. And I think that that's so emblematic of the issue. Nobody noticed or critiqued the fact that neither Blue and White, which is the Labor Party, nor Likud, Netanyahu's party, or Kadima, or any other party, none of them had Palestine as an issue, or Palestinians. It's not a debate issue, it's not a platform issue, it just doesn't even matter. So they don't need to discuss the future of, you know, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza under occupation, nor are they discussing the future of Palestinian citizens of Israel who are living as a fifth column. To the extent that they're discussing them, it's in very racist terms, as Netanyahu made clear, that we have to make sure that we vote so that these Palestinian citizens of Israel, who constitute 20% of the population, aren't able to exercise any power. But he's using racist, fear-mongering tropes that are so insidious that even Facebook suspends his Facebook account because of what he's writing, right? And yet, what's so emblematic is not even just, you know, what the elections tell us, but the coverage of the elections, what it tells us, is that Palestinians are appearing once again as shadows of Israel. We matter to the extent that Israel matters, or that they say that we matter and how we matter to them, but never on our own terms. And so one of the things that I highlighted is, not only are we not part of the election platform, but check this out, we're denied sovereignty and the ability to be self-governing in, you know, a state in the West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem at its capital, because Israel has sabotaged a Palestinian state. And so clearly, with the increase of the settlement population from 200,000 to 600,000, so clearly with the building of the annexation wall where they take 13% of West Bank lands, so clearly where they bifurcate Gaza from the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank, and then seal off Gaza and subject it to repeated wars, so clearly in that they basically are declaring their jurisdiction over all of Jerusalem as a united capital of Israel, thereby undermining the possibility of a Palestinian, you know, East Jerusalem as the capital of a Palestinian state, so clearly as to then annex or promise to annex the Jordan Valley, which is 30% of the West Bank. I mean, Israel is basically, in deed, in practice, in word, made clear to the world that there's never going to be a Palestinian state, so they've denied them sovereignty. At the same time that here they are going to elections the second time that year and also denying them the right to vote, to participate. If you're not going to let us be sovereign and have our own state, then you may as well allow us to be part of the state and decide our own future, since Israel is going to be making those decisions on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So I would ask anybody, you know, if you don't know, and there's a lot of details to understand, you know, Israel's systems of dispossession, displacement, removal, and exile, right? It's very intricate set of various legal jurisdictions it applies within Israel, in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, which are distinct. But let's say you know nothing, and all you know is that Israel has denied Palestinians the right to be sovereign and denied them the right to vote since 1967. So we're talking about 52 years. What do you think it is? Right? I'm just stating the obvious when I tell you, okay, that's an apartheid condition. Here you're exercising spatial and political segregation based on racial differentiation and distinction as to the kinds of rights that Palestinians and Israelis have, regardless of where they live. So, yeah, I would say that that's a system tantamount to apartheid on the very face of it. I would complicate it a little bit like this. Yes, it's apartheid, but the way that I see it, this apartheid racialized regime is one that Israel uses because it's the most effective in order to consolidate the territorial takings of Palestinian lands that Israel has achieved, and to consolidate those takings and to continue the ongoing and steady removal of Palestinians and their concentration onto smaller and smaller areas of land in a broader project of settler colonialism, military occupation, which is its own set of laws, It's a form of humanitarian law, and one that, you know, is applied as a legitimate matter to transition from wartime to peacetime, and is supposed to be temporary, and which is clearly not about civil rights, right? It's truncating those rights as an emergency regime. That regime is also applied in the West Bank, and until 2005 was applied very diligently in the Gaza Strip, although despite the withdrawal of troops from Gaza, it's still occupied. But suffice it to say that you can have military occupation in those territories, civil law within Israel, a mix of administrative and martial law in East Jerusalem, and all-out warfare in the Gaza Strip. You know, let's not get lost in that legal milieu, which we should as legal scholars and analysts dissect, but just on the face of it. It's a settler colonial project, and apartheid is a legal system that successfully and effectively enables Israel to consolidate its settler colonial takings and continue them.
I appreciate you breaking that down for us so thoroughly. I mean, I think one of the things I wanted to ask you is that I was in Palestine earlier this year, and we went to the so-called military courts, watched these so-called trials where a few Palestinians would be dragged in, chained to each other. This entire proceeding would happen in 2 or 3 minutes. We saw multiple people, you know, sentenced to months to years for strictly Facebook posts or throwing rocks. And it was striking and disorienting seeing something that was so different yet felt so similar to those of us who've done criminal defense work here, to how criminal shootings here operate, and also how land dispossession operates here too. I know that you've really seriously engaged in both Indigenous and Black solidarity work with Palestine. Why is that so important to you?
Sure. So I wanna one, say yes. Let me start with the second question and go to the first. So the first one is absolutely I engage in solidarity work, because as far as I'm concerned, the question of Palestine is not just a national liberation question, but is a question about feminism, class, racism, clearly about, you know, attachments to land, indigenous cosmologies, and so on and so forth. And so refugees, we're talking militarization, surveillance, criminalization. So these are all tropes that are universal in nature. They get applied in a particular way in Palestine, which seems to us quite unique in 2019, but was perhaps much more emblematic of the 1960s and 1970s, when the majority of the Earth's populations were living under some sort of imperial and colonial dominion. And so Palestine was part of that decolonization agenda, remains an outstanding piece of it. And so now it seems, you know, distinct and odd and obviously are very unique, distinctive factors of it. Nonetheless, is similar when we talk about horizons for freedom. And in terms of settler colonization, that's the same as settler colonization in North America or Canada or Australia or Hawaii or New Zealand. We're talking about the same system, which is predicated on two basic prongs, right? The first is to take as much territory as possible without the native people. And the second is to concentrate as many natives as possible on the smaller and smaller amounts of territory and land so that you can extend settler sovereignty. That's very clear. In terms of, you know, when we think about Black Palestinian solidarity, what are the things that, you know, that bring us together there? I like to stay away from a politics of similarity. You know, well, we're criminalized, therefore we are the same. We're excluded, therefore we are the same. I like to stay away from a politics of similarity in order to make a broader point about Black Palestinian solidarity, which is, it's a commitment. It's a political analytic, to anti-imperialism that sees racism and colonialism as co-constitutive structures. So that politics of domination, exploitation, dispossession are entwined with the politics of racial subordination and racial privileging, right? So how, and again, the analytical things that enable us to see, well, these systems, if we understand one, we can understand the other. So that's in terms of the solidarity, it's a commitment. You know, my commitment to freedom isn't just to national liberation. It's to gender liberation, right? It's to class struggle. It's to equity. And so that's just also what drives me as a moral compass. You brought up the military courts. The only thing I would highlight to the listeners is that despite similarities, the military courts are going to be different than criminal courts in the United States. Yes, they're similarly unjust. Yes, obviously they're overrepresentative of minorities. But in Israeli military courts only try Palestinians. It's a 99.9% conviction rate. It's judicial rules and judicial process that are completely different. You do not have, you know, you do not need, you don't have a jury. You don't get to prove innocence. There's no presumption of innocence. There's, you don't get to cross-examine anybody. Testimony of one person and one soldier is sufficient. One Palestinian informant of another Palestinian throwing a stone is sufficient. In addition to the fact that there's something known as administrative detention, where Israelis can literally detain Palestinians for 6 months at a time without charge or trial, and extend that 6 months indefinitely. So you can be in detention for 5 years and never have any charges pressed against you or a trial. So as much as we can see the similarities in the injustice, to collapse those things as being the same, I think, is not helpful, because it also then obscures how, you know, distinct these military courts are and what they're doing and how they produce these different identities for Palestinians as racialized, as criminalized, as subordinated and dispossessed.
Thank you for pulling through those strains of what's similar and what's different. One other thing that did feel similar are the lawyers who were still doing the work in these Palestinian courts. I was struck by people who were saying that we're literally here to do harm reduction in a court where there's a 99.9%, as you said, conviction rate. And how is it that lawyers can conceive of themselves doing this day in and day out in the face of just total brutality? So I guess related to that, I'm wondering what words of advice you have for law students here in the U.S. who are trying to figure out how to do work that's in solidarity with Palestine, despite both very siloed public interest professions and also a very well-coordinated backlash against especially people of color who try to connect these worlds.
So, no, this is a great question. One of the questions you're asking and implying in the first one is, how does one sustain the energy to continue work on behalf of a lost cause? Right? To add to that dimension, especially in a legal system where you're mostly losing. I mean, I think that public defenders in the United States know this. I hear this from my public defender friends all of the time. They've got 300 clients. They're under-resourced. They're maxed out. They're pleading out their clients as fast as possible and not giving them the best representation. They know they're not giving them the best representation. They cannot do that as a matter of structure. And yet here, and they're losing most of the time, and yet here they are day in and day out doing their best. And it does. It feels like that sometimes, that all we're doing is making the harm a little bit less harmful, but we're not, you know, solving the issue. And this is the bigger question about for lawyers and movement lawyering, right? Is this the work to be done, or are there other ways to combat these issues where you can do more than just harm reduction? And I think that there are. I think, you know, that's where we get into strategic litigation, movement lawyering, where you do work on behalf of movements. You're not overly relying on that very oppressive courtroom, but you're using that as a tool. And this is what I advance in my book. The law is a tool. And it's only going to be, you know, we can only leverage its emancipatory potential to the extent that we're using it on behalf of a political movement. So one of the ways I say to stay, you know, keep your hopes up and your chin up is, don't overemphasize what the law can do in the first place. That's part of the bigger structure and the bigger work that's happening in knowledge production, in, you know, in mentorship, in social reproduction, and what, you know, in care and feminist resistance and other forms of resistance and congressional representation, so that the work that's being done in the courtroom is part of a broader fabric. And so don't despair. right? You shouldn't despair. You're not at the center of this. You're a piece of this. And so it's really critical to be part of something bigger. In terms of Palestine specifically, then how do you, you know, practice that allyship? I mean, you hit the nail on the head. There's so much backlash. It's a big deal. Frankly, you know, because I was at Harvard Law School speaking, it's a big deal for Harvard Law students to be going on treks to Palestine. These are students that have reached, I mean, let's just be really frank, that have reached, you know, the top echelons of socioeconomic, political stratosphere and will forever land in places of influence, whether they're the future governors, presidents, right? Attorney generals, justices. They're in these classrooms. And so the greatest, I think, the best part of the work is not to drop Palestine when it becomes politically expedient to do so. Because every young attorney and politician and aspiring professional will probably have that challenge in their lifetime. And so my ask is, don't do it. Don't drop us, right? Somehow keep Palestine as part of that framework as you would anything else that you believe in that's part of your moral and political compass.
I appreciate that. And you answered what was going to be my last question for you in the first part of being a part of something bigger, that what I find really inspiring about you is that you hold these very radical possibilities even as you discuss in your book that the law is politics and we can't cede it. And I know that for law students who are doing justice work, it feels difficult to do both, to both be practical and to also be unconstrained in what we imagine for the future.
You're not supposed to be. You're not supposed to be. You're disciplined. You're boxed in. Your road to success is predicated on you being really disciplined, right? So I always tell young people that I work with and sometimes mentor, I'm at a particular stage in my career where it's kind of working out for me. Right? The book has been received well. I've landed on my feet in the academy, more or less. I've been able to be, you know, to penetrate, mainstream media on these issues. I've been able to be taken seriously amongst my professional, you know, peers and colleagues and academic associations and so on and so forth. I'm being, you know, I can see how that looks like, oh, okay, but somehow, That's, you know, you made it work. But what I want to emphasize is that I was always a radical experiment. I was always a radical experiment. And it could have very well not worked, right? The book could have been rejected and it might still be attacked, but in the sense that it might have just totally flopped. I could have been driven out of university through harassment, which was real. And has happened, right? There are a number of alternative possibilities that could have been, that weren't. But at a certain point, I was a radical experiment. If I failed, I would have proven that experiment is not worth the risk. And should I succeed, and my success is not a done deal yet, obviously, and we're still on the come up, but should I succeed, then it encourages others to also take similar risks. But that's what this is. This is about risk taking. And so it's really hard. It's really hard, I you know, to even graduate law school and be the same person you were when you first graduated, and even what you believe in, even what you believe in. And that, those kinds of things happen over time. So that's a personal journey between each person, you know, who they feel themselves accountable to, which, you know, and that's my advice. Who are you accountable to, you know? You can't just be accountable to yourself. I think that that's quite selfish and just, you know, it's basically all, that's it. Anything is possible. I find myself accountable to my community. That's who I want to be accountable to. My community of people I don't know, but who I want to work with and on behalf of, but also community of friends and family that are holding me to account for, you know, for the things that I talk about and making sure that I remain, that I continue to act with integrity. And I think that those, you know, everybody's got their own journey. So there's no silver bullet. There's no magic blueprint. You're going to figure it out as you go. And a lot of times you might find yourself building your own ladder and to just continue to have faith in yourself that you too can be the radical experiment and you too can succeed. Good luck.
Well, thank you so much for risk-taking and for reminding us what to be accountable for and for making time to talk to CRCL today. To those listening, for more on this, you can find a link to Nora's book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, along with this recording. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on my host.